He reached for their printout. "May I see?" he asked. Hands fluttering wildly, Imad handed it over. Binet scanned the rows of figures, calmly at first, then with rising agitation. He had been pondering all year long certain implications of the theory of universal gravitation, which his mentor, Athor, had brought to such a summit of perfection. It had been Athor's great triumph, the making of his lofty reputation, to work out the orbital motions of Kelgash and all six of its suns according to rational principles of attractive forces. Binet, using modern computational equipment, had been calculating some aspects of Kalgash's orbit around Onos, its primary sun, when, to his horror, he observed that his figures didn't check out properly in terms of the theory of universal gravitation. The theory said that at the beginning of the present year, Kalgash should have been here in relation to Onos, when in undeniable fact Kalgash was there. The deviation was trivial, a matter of a few decimal places. But that wasn't trivial at all, in the larger sense of things. The theory of universal gravitation was so precise that most people preferred to refer to it as the law of universal gravitation. Its mathematical underpinning was considered impeccable. But a theory that purports to explain the movements of the world through space has no room for even small discrepancies. Either it is complete or it is not complete. No middle way was permissible. And a difference of a few decimal places in a short-range calculation would widen into a vast abyss, Binet knew, if more ambitious computations were attempted. What good was the whole theory of universal gravitation if the position that it said Kalgash was going to hold in the sky a century from now turned out to be halfway around Onos from the planet's actual location then? Binet had gone over his figures until he was sick of reworking them. The result was always the same. But what was he supposed to believe? His numbers or Athor's towering master scheme? His piddling notions of astronomy or the great Athor's profound insight into the fundamental structure of the universe? He imagined himself standing right on top of the dome of the observatory, calling out, "Listen to me, everybody. Athor's theory is wrong. I've got the figures right here that disprove it." Which would bring forth such gales of laughter that he'd be blown clear across the continent. Who was he to set himself up against the titanic Athor? Who could possibly believe that a callow assistant professor had toppled the law of universal gravitation? And yet... His eyes raced over the printout sheets that Imad and Faro had prepared. The calculations on the first two pages were unfamiliar to him. He had set up the data for the two students in such a way that the underlying relationships from which the numbers were derived were not at all obvious. And evidently they had approached the problem in a way that any astronomer trying to compute a planetary orbit would regard as quite unorthodox, which was exactly what Binet had wanted. The orthodox ways had led him only into catastrophic conclusions, but he had too much information at his own disposal to be able to work in any other mode but the orthodox ones. Faro and Imad hadn't been hampered in that fashion. But as he followed along their line of reasoning, Binet began to notice a discomforting convergence of the numbers. By the third page, they had locked in with his own calculations, which he knew by heart by this time. And from there on, everything followed in an orderly way, step by step by step, to the same dismaying, shattering, inconceivable, totally unacceptable culminating result. Binet looked up at the two students, aghast. "There's no possibility, is there, that you've slipped up somewhere? This string of integrations here, for example, they look pretty tricky." "Sir!" Imad cried, sounding shocked to the core. His face was bright red and his arms waved about as if moving of their own accord. Faro said more placidly, "I'm afraid they're correct, sir. They tally frontwards and backwards." "Yes, I imagine they do," said Binet dully. He struggled to conceal his anguish, but his hands were shaking so badly that the printout sheets began to flutter in his grasp. He started to put them down on the table before him, but his wrist jerked uncontrollably in a very Imad-like gesture and sent them scattering all over the floor. Faro knelt to pick them up. He gave Binet a troubled look.
"Sir, if we've upset you in any way..."
"No, no, not at all. I didn't sleep well today, that's the problem. But this is fine work, unquestionably very fine. I'm proud of you. To take a problem like this, one which has utterly no real-world resonance at all, which in fact is in total contradiction of real-world scientific truth,
and to follow so methodically to the conclusion required by the data while succeeding in ignoring the fact that the initial premise is absurd, why, it's a splendid job, an admirable demonstration of your powers of logic, a first-rate thought experiment. He saw them exchange quick glances. He wondered if he was fooling them even slightly. And now, he went on, if you'll excuse me, fellas, I have another conference. Rolling the damning papers into a tight cylinder, Binet shoved them under his arm and rushed past them out the door, down the hall, practically running, heading for the safety and privacy of his own tiny office. My God, he thought. My God, my God, my God, what have I done? And what will I do now? He buried his head in his hands and waited for the throbbing to stop. But it didn't seem to be planning to stop. After a moment, he sat up and jabbed his finger against the communicator button on his desk. Get me the Sorrow City Chronicle, he told the machine. Theremin 762. From the communicator came a long, maddening burst of cracklings and hissings. Then, suddenly, Theremin's deep voice.
Teacher's desk, Theremin 762.
Binet.
What's that? I can't hear what you're saying.
Binet realized that he hadn't managed to get out anything more than a croak.
It's Binet, I said. I want to change our appointment time.
To change it? Look, fella, I understand how you feel about mornings because so do I, but I've absolutely got to talk to you no later than noon tomorrow, or I'll have no story here. I'll make it up to you any way I can, but you don't understand. I want to see you sooner, not later, Theremin.
What?
This evening, let's say 9:30, or 10 if you can't make it. I thought you had photographs to take at the observatory. The deuce with the photographs, man. I need to see you.
Need to, Binet?
What's happened?
Is it something with Raista?
It has nothing to do with Raista in the slightest.
9:30, at the Six Suns?
Six Suns, 9:30,
yes, Theremin said.
It's a date.
Binet broke the contact and sat for a long moment staring at the rolled paper cylinder before him, somberly shaking his head. He felt fractionally calmer now, but only fractionally. Confiding in Theremin would make it easier to bear the burden of all this. He trusted Theremin completely. Newsmen were not generally noted for their trustworthiness, Binet knew, but Theremin was a friend first, a journalist after that. He had never betrayed Binet's confidence, not once. Even so, Binet didn't have any idea of his next move. Maybe Theremin would be able to come up with something. Maybe. He left the observatory by the back stairs, sneaking out by the fire escape like a thief. He didn't dare risk the possibility of running into Athor by going out the main way. It was appalling to him to consider the possibility of seeing Athor now, having to confront him face to face, man to man. He found the motor scooter ride home a terrifying one. At every moment he was afraid that the laws of gravity would cease to hold true, that he would go soaring off into the heavens. But at last Binet reached the little apartment that he shared with Raista 717. She gasped when she saw him.
Binet, you're as white as a...
Ghost, yes. He reached for her and pulled her close against him.
Hold me, he said. Hold me.
What is it? What's happened?
I'll tell you later, he said. Just hold me.
8. Theremin was at the Six Suns Club a little after 9. It was probably a good idea to get a head start on Binet. A quick drink or two first, just to lubricate his brain a little. The astronomer had sounded awful, as though he was keeping hysteria at bay only by some tremendous effort. Theremin couldn't imagine what terrible thing could have happened to him, there in the seclusion and stillness of the observatory, to make such a wreck out of him in so short a time. But plainly, Binet was in big trouble, and plainly he was going to need the highest quality help Theremin could provide.
Let me have a tonneau special, Theremin told the waiter.
Make it a double. Tonneau Setha, okay?
Double white light, the waiter said. Coming up.
The evening was mild. Theremin, who was well known here and received special treatment, had been given his regular warm weather table on the terrace overlooking the city. The lights of downtown sparkled gaily. Onos had set an hour or two ago, and only Trey and Patru were in the sky, burning brightly in the east, casting harsh twin shadows as they made their descent toward morning. Looking at them, Theremin wondered which suns would be in the sky tomorrow. It was different all the time, a brilliant, ever-changing display. Onos, certainly. You could always be sure of seeing Onos at least part of the time every day of the year. Even he knew that. And then what? Dovim, Tano, and Setha, to make it a four-sun day? He wasn't sure. Maybe it was supposed to be just Tano and Setha, with Onos visible only for a few hours at midday. That would be gloomy. But then, after a second sip, he reminded himself that this wasn't the season for short Onos rises. So it would be a three-sun day, most likely. Unless it was going to be just Onos and Dovim tomorrow. It was so hard to keep it all straight. Well, he could ask to see an almanac if he really cared, but he didn't. Some people always seemed to know what tomorrow's suns would be like. Bine was one, naturally. But Theramon took a more happy-go-lucky approach to it all, so long as some sun was going to be up there the next day. Theramon didn't especially care which one it was. And there always was one, two, or three, actually, or sometimes four. You could count on that. Even five once in a while. His drink arrived. He took a deep gulp and exhaled in pleasure. What a delightful thing a Tano special was. The good, strong, white rum of the Velkarine Islands, mixed with a shot of the even stronger product, clear and tangy, that they distilled on the coast of Bagillar. And just a dab of Sgarino juice to take the edge off. Ah, magnificent. Theramon wasn't a particularly heavy drinker, certainly not the way newspaper men were legendarily supposed to be. But he counted it a shabby day when he couldn't find time for one or two Tano specials in those quiet, dusky hours after Onos had set. "You look like you're enjoying that, Theramon," a familiar voice said behind him. "Bine, you're early." "Oh, 10 minutes. What are you drinking?"
"The usual, a Tano special."
"Good. I think I'll have one, too."
"You?"
Theramon stared at his friend. Fruit juice was about Bine's speed, so far as he knew. He couldn't recall ever having seen the astronomer drink anything stronger. But Bine looked strange this evening. Haggard, weary, worn. His eyes had an almost feverish glow to them.
"Waiter," Theramon called.
It was alarming to see Bine gulp his drink. He gasped after the first slug as though the impact was a lot greater than he'd been expecting. But then he went back to it quickly for a second deep pull, and a third.
"Easy," Theramon urged. "Your head'll be swimming in 5 minutes."
"It's swimming already."
"You had a drink before you came here?"
"No, not a drink," Bine said. "A shock. An upset." He put his drink down and peered balefully at the city lights. After a moment, he picked it up again, almost absent-mindedly, and drained what was left. "I shouldn't have another one so soon, should I, Theramon?"
"I doubt it very much."
Theramon reached out and let his hand rest lightly on the astronomer's wrist.
"What's going on, fellow? Tell me about it."
"It's hard to explain."
"Come on, I've been around the track a little, you know. You and Raista..."
"No, I told you before, this has nothing to do with her. Nothing."
"All right, I believe you."
Bine said, "Maybe I should have that second drink."
"In a little while. Come on, Bine, what is it?"
Bine sighed. "You know what the theory of universal gravitation is, don't you, Theramon?"
"Of course I do. I mean, I couldn't tell you what it means exactly. There are only 12 people on Kalgash who truly understand it, isn't that so? But I can certainly tell you what it is, more or less."
"So you believe that garbage too," Bine said with a harsh laugh, "about the theory of gravitation being so complicated that only 12 people can understand its math."
"Well, that's what I've always heard."
"What you've always heard is ignorant folk wisdom," said Bine. "I could give you all the essential math in a sentence, and you'd probably understand what I was saying, too."
"You could?"
"I would? No question of it. Look, Theramon, the law of universal gravitation, the theory of universal gravitation, I mean, states that there exists a cohesive force among all bodies of the universe, and that the amount of this force between any two given bodies is proportional to the product of their masses divided by the square of the distance between them. It's that simple."
"Is that all there is to it?"
"Well, that's enough. It took 400 years to develop it."
"Why that long? It seems simple enough the way you put it."
"Because great laws aren't divined by flashes of inspiration, no matter what you newspaper people like to believe. It usually takes the combined work of a world full of scientists over a period of centuries. Ever since Genovi 41 discovered that Kalgash rotates around Onos rather than vice versa. And that was about fortunes of the six were recorded and analyzed and unwoven. Theory after theory was advanced and checked and counterchecked and modified and abandoned and revived and converted to something else. It was a deuce of a job." Theramon nodded thoughtfully and finished off his drink. He signaled the waiter for two more. Bine seemed calm enough so long as he was talking about science, he thought. "It was some 30 years ago," the astronomer continued,
that Athor 77 put the touch of perfection on the whole thing by demonstrating that the theory of universal gravitation accounts exactly for the orbital motions of the six suns. It was an amazing achievement. It was one of the greatest feats of sheer logic anyone has ever accomplished.
I know how you revere that man, Theremin said, but what does all this have to do with...
I'm getting to the point. Binet rose and walked to the edge of the terrace, carrying his second drink with him. He stood there in silence for a time, looking out at distant Trey and Patru. It seemed to Theremin that Binet was growing agitated again, but the newspaper man said nothing. After a time, Binet took a long gulp of his drink. Standing with his back still turned, he said finally, "The problem is this. A few months ago, I began working on a recalculation of the motions of Calgash around Onos, using the big new university computer. I provided the computer with the last 6 weeks' actual observations of Calgash's orbit and told it to predict the orbital movements for the rest of the year. I didn't expect any surprises. Mainly, I just wanted an excuse to fool around with the computer, I guess. Naturally, I used the gravitational laws in setting up my calculations." He swung around suddenly. His face had a bleak, haunted look.
"Theremin, it didn't come out right."
"I don't understand."
"The orbit the computer produced didn't match up with the hypothetical orbit I was expecting to get. I don't mean that I was simply working on the basis of a pure Calgash-Ono system, you realize. I took into account all perturbations that the other suns would cause. And what I got, what the computer was claiming to be the true orbit of Calgash, was something very different from the orbit that is indicated by Athor's theory of gravitation."
"But you said you used Athor's gravitational laws in setting things up," said Theremin, puzzled.
"I did."
"Well, then how..."
Suddenly, Theremin's eyes brightened.
"Good Lord, man! What a story! Are you telling me that the brand new supercomputer at Sorrow University, installed at a cost of I don't want to think how many millions of credits, is inaccurate? That there's been a gigantic, scandalous waste of the taxpayers' money? That..."
"There's nothing wrong with the computer, Theremin. Believe me."
"Can you be sure of that?"
"Positive."
"Well, then, what..."
"I might have given the computer erroneous figures, maybe. It's a terrific computer, but it can't get the right answer from the wrong data."
"So that's why you're so upset, Binet. Listen, man, it's only human to make an error once in a while. You mustn't be so harsh on yourself. You..."
"I needed to be completely certain that I had fed the right numbers into the computer, first of all, and also that I had given it the right theoretical postulates to use in processing those numbers,"
said Binet, clutching his glass so tightly that his hand shook. The glass was empty now, Theremin noticed.
"As you say, it's only human to make an error once in a while. So I called in a couple of hotshot young graduate students and let them work on the problem. They had their results for me today. That was the meeting I had that was so important when I said I couldn't see you. Theremin, they confirmed my findings. They got the same deviation in the orbit that I did."
"Oh, but if the computer was right, then..."
"Then..."
Theremin shook his head.
"Then what? The theory of universal gravitation is wrong? Is that what you're saying?"
"Yes."
The word appeared to have come from Binet at a terrible price. He seemed stunned, dazed, devastated. Theremin studied him. No doubt this was confusing for Binet and probably very embarrassing, but the journalist still couldn't understand why the impact of all this on him was so powerful. Then abruptly he understood everything.
"It's Athor! You're afraid of hurting Athor, aren't you?"
"That's it exactly," said Binet, giving Theremin a look of almost pathetic gratitude for having seen the true situation. He threw himself down in his chair, shoulders hunched, head lowered. In a muffled voice, he said, "It would kill the old man to know that someone's poked a hole in his wonderful theory, that I, of all people, had poked a hole in it. He's been like a second father to me, Theremin. Everything I've accomplished in the past 10 years has been done under his guidance, with his encouragement, with his love, in a manner of speaking. And now I repay it like this. I wouldn't just be destroying his life's work. I'd be stabbing him. Theremin, him."
"Have you considered simply suppressing your findings?"
Binet looked astonished.
"You know I couldn't do that."
"Yes, yes, I do know, but I had to find out whether you were thinking of it."
"Whether I was thinking of the unthinkable? No, of course not. It never entered my mind. But what am I going to do, Theremin?
I suppose I could just throw all the papers away and pretend I never looked into the whole subject, but that would be monstrous. So what it comes down to is I have a choice between violating my own scientific conscience and ruining Aethor, ruining the man I look upon not simply as the head of my profession, but as my own philosophical mentor.
He can't have been much of a mentor, then.
The astronomer's eyes widened in astonishment and fury.
What are you saying, Theremin?
Easy, easy.
Theremin spread his hands wide in a conciliatory gesture.
It seems to me you're being awfully condescending to him, Bene. If Aethor's really the great man you think he is, he's not going to put his own reputation above scientific truth.
You see what I mean? Aethor's theory is not cast iron.
No theory is, and there's always room for improvement. Isn't that so? Science is constructed out of approximations that gradually approach the truth. You told me a long time back, and I've never forgotten it. Well, that means all theories are subject to constant testing and modification, doesn't it? And if it eventually turns out that they're not quite close enough to the truth, they need to be replaced by something that's closer. Right, Bene? Right?
Bene was trembling now. He looked very pale.
Could you get me another drink, Theremin?
No. Listen to me, there's more. You say that you're so worried about Aethor. He's old. I suppose he's pretty frail. That you don't have the heart to tell him that you've found a flaw in his theory. All right. That's a decent and loving position to take. But think about this, will you? If calculating the orbit of Kelgash is all that important, somebody else is likely to stumble across the same flaw in Aethor's theory sooner or later, and that other person isn't likely to be as tactful in letting Aethor know about it as you'd be. He might even be a professional rival of Aethor's, an outright enemy of his. Every scientist has enemies, you've told me so plenty of times.
Wouldn't it be better for you to go to Aethor and tell him gently, carefully, of what you've discovered, than for him to find out about it one morning in the Chronicle?
Yes, Bene whispered. You're completely right.
You'll go to him then?
Yes, yes, I have to, I suppose. Bene bit his lip.
I feel miserable about this, Theremin. I feel like a murderer.
I know you do, but it isn't Aethor you'll be murdering. It's a defective theory.
Defective theories must never be allowed to persist. You owe it to Aethor as well as yourself to let the truth emerge.
Theremin hesitated. A sudden, startling new idea had occurred to him.
Of course, there's one other possibility. I'm only a layman, you know, and you'll probably laugh. Is there any chance that the theory of gravitation might be correct despite everything, and that the computer's figures for Kalgash's orbit are right also, and that some other factor entirely, something altogether unknown, might be responsible for the discrepancy in your result?
That could be, I suppose, said Bene in a flat, dispirited tone. But once you begin dragging in mysterious unknown factors, you begin to move into the realm of fantasy. I'll give you an example. Let's say there's an invisible seventh sun out there. It's got mass, it exerts gravitational force, but we simply can't see it. Since we don't know it's there, we haven't plugged it into our gravitational calculations, and so the figures come out cockeyed. Is that what you mean?
Well, why not?
Why not five invisible suns, then? Why not 50? Why not an invisible giant who pushed planets around according to his whims? Why not a huge dragon whose breath deflects Kalgash from its proper path? We can't disprove it, can we? When you start in with why nots, Theremin, anything becomes possible, and then nothing makes any sense. At least not to me. I can only deal with what I know is real. You may be right that there's an unknown factor, and therefore the gravitational laws aren't invalid. I certainly hope so. But I can't do serious work on that basis. All I can do is go to Aethor, which I will, I promise you that, and tell him what the computer has told me. I don't dare suggest to him or anybody that I blame the whole mess on a hitherto undiscovered unknown factor. Otherwise, I'd sound just as crazy as the Apostles of Flame, who claim to know all sorts of mystic revelations. Theremin, I really want that other drink now.
Yes, all right. And speaking of the Apostles of Flame,
you want a statement from me, I remember.
Bene passed a hand wearily in front of his face.
Yes, yes, I won't let you down. You've been a tremendous help to me this evening. What is it exactly that the apostles have said now? I forget.
It was Mondior 71, said Theremin. The grand high mumbo-jumbo himself. What he said was, let me think. that the time is very near when the gods intend to purge the world of sin, that he can calculate the exact day, even the exact hour, when doom will arrive.
Bine groaned.
So what's new about that? Isn't that what they've been saying for years?
Yes, but they're starting to hand out more of the gory details now. It's the notion of the apostles, you know, that this won't be the first time the world has been destroyed. They teach that the gods have deliberately made mankind imperfect, as a test, and that they have given us a single year, one of their divine years, not one of our little ones, in which to shape up. That's called a year of godliness, and it's exactly 2049 of our years long. Again and again, when the year of godliness has ended, the gods have discovered that, we're still wicked and sinful, and so they have destroyed the world by sending down heavenly flames from holy places in the sky that are known as stars, so say the apostles anyway.
Stars? Binet said. Does he mean the suns?
No, stars. Mondior says that the stars are specifically different from the six suns.
Haven't you ever paid any attention to this stuff, Binet?
No, why in the world should I?
Well, in any event, when the year of godliness ends and nothing on Kalgash has improved, morally speaking, these stars drop some sort of a holy fire on us and burn us up. Mondior says this has happened any number of times. But each time it does, the gods are merciful, or at least a faction among them is. Every time the world is destroyed, the kinder gods prevail over the sterner ones, and humanity is given one more chance. And so the godliest of the survivors are rescued from the Holocaust, and a new deadline is set. Mankind gets another 2049 years to cast off its evil ways. The time is almost up again, says Mondior. It's just under 2048 years since the last cataclysm. In something like 14 months, the suns will all disappear, and these hideous stars of his will shoot flame down out of a black sky to wipe out the wicked. Next year, on Theptar 19th, to be specific.
14 months, Binet said in a musing way. The 19th of Theptar. He's very precise about it, isn't he? I suppose he knows the exact time of day it'll happen, too.
Well, so he says, yes. That's why I'd like a statement from somebody connected with the observatory, preferably you. Mondior's latest announcement is that the exact time of the catastrophe can be calculated scientifically. That it isn't simply something that's set forth as dogma in the Book of Revelations, but that it's subject to the same sort of computation that astronomers employ when Theremin faltered and halted.
When we calculate the orbital motions of the suns in the world? Binet asked acidly.
Well, yes, Theremin said, looking abashed.
Then maybe there's hope for the world after all, if the apostles can't do any better job of it than we do.
I need a statement, Binet.
Yes, I realize that.
The next round of drinks had arrived. Binet wrapped his hand around his glass.
Try this, he said after a moment. The main task of science is to separate truth from untruth, in the hope of revealing the way the universe really works. Putting truth to work in the service of untruth is not what we at the university think of as the scientific way. We are capable now of predicting the movements of the suns in the heavens, yes, but even if we use our best computer, we are no closer than we ever were to being able to foretell the will of the gods. Nor will we ever be, I suspect. How's that?
Perfect, Theremin said. Let's see if I've got it. The main task of science is to separate truth from untruth, in the hope of, what came next, Binet?
Binet repeated the whole thing word for word, as though he had memorized it hours before. Then he drained his third drink at a single, astonishing long gulp. And then he stood up, smiled for the first time all evening, and fell flat on his face. 9. Aethor 77's eyes narrowed, and he scrutinized the little sheaf of printouts lying before him on the desk as though they were maps of continents that no one had ever known existed. He was very calm. He was amazed at how calm he was.
"Very interesting, Binet," he said slowly. "Very, very interesting."
"Of course, sir, there's always the possibility that not only have I made some crucial error in fundamental assumptions, but that Imat and Faro also..."
"All three of you getting your basic postulates wrong? No, Binet, I think not."
"I just wanted to indicate that the possibility exists."
Please,
Athor said.
Let me think.
It was mid-morning. Onos in full glory blazed in the sky that was visible through the tall window of the observatory director's office. Dovim was barely apparent, a small, hard red dot of light, making a high northerly transit. Athor fingered the papers, moving them about again and again on his desk, and moved them yet again. How strange to be taking this so easily, he thought. Binet was the one who seemed all wrought up over it. He himself had scarcely reacted at all. Perhaps I'm in shock, Athor speculated. Over here, sir, I have the orbit of Kalgash according to the generally accepted almanac computation, and here, on the printout, we have the orbital prediction that the new computer...
Please, Binet, I said I wanted to think.
Binet nodded jerkily. Athor smiled at him. Not an easy thing for Athor to do. The formidable head of the observatory, a tall, thin, commanding-looking man with an impressive shock of thick white hair, had allowed himself so long ago to slip into the role of austere giant of science that it was difficult for him to unbend and permit himself to show ordinary human responses. At least, it was difficult for him while he was here at the observatory, where everyone looked upon him as a sort of demigod. At home, with his wife, with his children, especially with his noisy flock of grandchildren, it was a different matter. So universal gravitation wasn't quite right, was it? No, no, that was impossible. Every atom of common sense in him protested at the thought. The concept of universal gravitation was fundamental to any comprehension of the structure of the universe, Athor was certain. Athor knew. It was too clean, too logical, too beautiful to be wrong. Take universal gravitation away and the entire logic of the cosmos dissolved into chaos. Inconceivable. Unimaginable. But these figures, this damnable printout of Binet's. I can see you're angry, sir, Binet chattering again. And I want to tell you, I can quite understand it. The way this must hit you. Anyone would be angry, having his life's work jeopardized this way.
Binet!
Just let me say, sir, that I'd give anything not to have had to bring you this today. I know you're furious with me for coming in here with this, but I can only say that I thought long and hard before I did. What I really wanted to do was burn everything and forget I ever got started on any of this. I'm appalled that I found what I did and appalled that I was the one who...
Binet!
Athor said again in his most ominous voice. Sir?
I am furious with you, yes, but not for the reason you think.
Sir?
Number one. I'm annoyed at the way you've been babbling at me when all I want to do is sit here and quietly work through the implications of these papers that you've just tossed at me. Number two, and much more important, I'm absolutely outraged that you'd have hesitated for so much as a moment to bring me your findings. Why did you wait so long?
It was only yesterday that I finished double-checking.
Yesterday? Then you should have been in here yesterday. Do you really mean to say, Binet, that you seriously considered suppressing all this? That you would have simply tossed your results away and said nothing?
No, sir, said Binet miserably. I never actually thought about doing that.
Well, that's a blessing. Tell me, man, do you think I'm so enamored of my own beautiful theory that I'd want one of my most gifted associates to shield me from the unpleasant news that the theory's got a flaw in it?
No, sir, of course not.
Then why didn't you come running in here with the news the moment you were sure you were right?
Because, sir, Binet looked as though he wanted to vanish into the carpet. Because I knew how upset you'd be. Because I thought you might... Well, you might be so upset that your health would be affected. So I held back. I talked to a couple of friends. I thought through my own position on all of this, and I came to see that I really had no choice. I had to tell you that the theory of...
So you really do believe I love my own theory more than I do the truth, eh?
Oh, no, no, sir. Again, Athor smiled, and this time it was no effort at all.
But I do, you know. I'm as human as anybody else, believe it or not. The theory of universal gravitation brought me every scientific honor this planet has to offer. It's my passport to immortality, Binet. You know that. And I have to deal with the possibility that the theory's wrong. Oh, it's a powerful shock, Binet. It goes right through me from front to back. Make no mistake about that. Of course, I still believe that my theory is correct.
Sir, said Binet, all too obviously aghast, but I've checked and checked and checked again, and
oh, your findings are correct, too, I'm sure of that. For you and Faro and Emot all to have done it wrong. No, no, I've already said I don't see much chance of that. But what you've got here doesn't necessarily overthrow universal gravitation.
Binet blinked a few times. It doesn't?
Certainly not,
Athor said, warming to the situation. He felt almost cheerful now. The deathly, unreal calm of the first few moments had given way to the very different tranquility that one feels when one is in pursuit of truth.
What does the theory of universal gravitation say, after all? That every body in the universe exerts a force on all other bodies proportional to mass and distance. And what did you attempt to do in using universal gravitation to compute the orbit of Galgash? Why, to factor in the gravitational impact that all the various astronomical bodies exert on our world as it travels around Onos. Is that not so?
Yes, sir.
Well, then, there's no need to throw the theory of universal gravitation out. At least, not at this point. What we need to do, my friend, is simply to rethink our comprehension of the universe and determine whether we're ignoring something that should be figured into our calculations. Some mysterious factor, that is, which all unbeknownst to us is exerting gravitational force on Galgash and isn't being taken into account.
Binet's eyebrows rose alarmingly. He gaped at Athor in what could only have been a look of total astonishment. Then he began to laugh. He smothered it at first by clamping his jaws, but the laughter insisted on escaping anyway, causing him to hunch his shoulders and emit strangled, lurching coughs, and then he had to clap both his hands over his mouth to hold back the torrent of merriment. Athor watched, flabbergasted.
An unknown factor,
Binet blurted after a moment.
A dragon in the sky! An invisible giant!
Dragons? Giants? What are you talking about, boy?
Yesterday evening, Theramon 762... Oh, sir, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
Binet struggled to regain his self-control. Muscles writhed in his face. He blinked violently and caught his breath. He turned away for an instant, and when he turned back, he was almost himself again. Shamefacedly, he said, I had a couple of drinks with Theramon 762.
You went to a newspaper man?
A very trustworthy one, a close friend.
They're all scoundrels, Binet, believe me.
Not this one, sir. I know him, and I know he'd never do anything to hurt me or offend me. In fact, Theramon gave me some excellent advice, by which I mean he said I absolutely had to come here, which is why I did. But also, trying to offer me some hope, you see, some consolation. He said the same thing you did, that maybe there was an unknown factor, his exact phrase, an unknown factor that was confusing our understanding of Kalgash's orbit. And I laughed and told him that it was useless to drag unknown factors into the situation, that it was too easy a solution. I suggested, sarcastically, of course, that if we allowed any such hypothesis, then we might as well tell ourselves that it was an invisible giant that was pushing Galgash out of orbit, or the breath of a giant dragon. And now here you are, sir, taking the same line of reasoning. Not a layman like Theramon, but the greatest astronomer in the world. Do you see how foolish I feel, sir?
I think I do, said Athor.
All this was becoming a little trying. He ran his hand through his imposing white mane and gave Binet a look of mingled irritation and compassion.
You were right to tell your friend that inventing fantasies to solve a problem isn't very useful. But the random suggestions of laymen aren't always without merit. For all we know, there is some unknown factor at work on Galgash's orbit. We need at least to consider that possibility before we toss the theory overboard. I think what we need to do here is to make use of Thargola's sword. You know what that is, Binet?
Of course, sir. The principle of parsimony. First put forth by the medieval philosopher Thargola 14, who said, we must drive a sword through any hypothesis that is not strictly necessary, or words to that effect.
Very good, Binet. Though the way I was taught it, it's if we are offered several hypotheses, we should begin our considerations by striking the most complex of them with our sword. Here we have the hypothesis that the theory of universal gravitation is in error, versus the hypothesis that you've left out some unknown and perhaps unknowable factor in making your calculations of the orbit of Kalgash. If we accept the first hypothesis, then everything we think we know about the structure of the universe tumbles into chaos. If we accept the second one, all we need to do is locate the unknown factor, and the fundamental order of things is preserved. It's a lot simpler to try to find something we may have overlooked than it would be to come up with a new general law governing the movements of heavenly bodies. So the hypothesis that the theory of gravitation is wrong falls before Thargola's sword, and we begin our investigations by working with the simpler explanation of the problem. Eh, Bine? What do you say?
Bine looked radiant. Then I haven't overthrown universal gravitation after all.
Not yet, anyway. You've probably won a place in scientific history for yourself, but we don't know yet whether it's as a debunker or as an originator. Let's pray it's the latter. And now, we need to do some very hard thinking, young man.
Aethor 77 closed his eyes and rubbed his forehead, which was beginning to ache. It had been a long time since he'd done any real science, he realized. He'd occupied himself almost entirely with administrative matters at the observatory for the past 8 or 10 years. But the mind that had produced the theory of universal gravitation might yet have a thought or two left in it, he told himself.
First, I want to take a closer look at these calculations of yours, he said. And then, I suppose, a closer look at my own theory.
10. The headquarters of the Apostles of Flame was a slender but magnificent tower of gleaming golden stone, rising like a shining javelin above the Sepatan River, in the exclusive Biragam quarter of Sorrow City. That soaring tower, Theramon thought, must be one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the entire capital. He had never stopped to consider it before, but the Apostles had to be an exceedingly wealthy group. They owned their own radio and television stations. They published magazines and newspapers. They had this tremendous tower, and probably they controlled all sorts of other assets, too, that were less visibly theirs. He wondered how that was possible. A bunch of fanatic Puritan monks? Where would they have managed to get their hands on so many hundreds of millions of credits? But he realized such well-known industrialists as Boddicker 888 and Vivine 99 were outspoken adherents of the teachings of Mondior and his apostles. It wouldn't surprise him to know that men like Boddicker and Vivine, and others like them, were heavy contributors to the Apostles' treasury. And if the organization was even a tenth as old as it claimed to be, 10,000 years was what they said, and if it had invested its money wisely over the centuries, there was no telling what the Apostles could have achieved through the miracle of compound interest, Theramon thought. They might be worth billions. They might secretly own half of Sorrow City. It was worth looking into, he told himself. He entered the vast echoing entrance hall of the great tower and peered about in awe. Though he had never been here before, he had heard it was an extraordinarily lavish building, both inside and out. But nothing he had heard had prepared him for the reality of the cultist's building. A polished marble floor with inlays in a half a dozen brilliant colors stretched as far as he could see. The walls were covered with glittering golden mosaics in abstract patterns, rising to arched vaults high overhead. Chandeliers of woven gold and silver threw a shimmering shower of brightness over everything. At the opposite end from the entrance, Theramon saw what seemed to be a model of the whole universe, fashioned apparently entirely of precious metals and gems. Immense suspended globes, which seemed to represent the 6 suns, hung from the ceiling by invisible wires. Each of them cast an eerie light,